Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
Parliament resumes on Tuesday at 2 p.m, back from a fortnight's adjournment coinciding with the school holidays, for a preview of the first of two sitting weeks, which will be followed by a week's break before a four-week session, including the budget on Thursday, May the 26th. Here's the Deputy Leader of the House, Simon Bridges.
Mr. Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, 3 May, the Government will look to complete the Appropriation 2014-15 Confirmation and Validation Bill, third reading of the Building Earthquake-Prone Buildings Amendment Bill, and make progress on a number of other bills on the order paper. Wednesday, 4 May, will be a Members' Day.
And that could be the highlight of the week if they get around to debating two bills, presently sitting in slots 2 and 3 on the Members' Order Paper. Both are from Labour MPs and have had the support of all opposition parties in their past. The first is the Keep Kiwi Bank Bill from Labour's David Parker. As its title suggests, its aim is to prevent the state-owned bank from being privatised by erecting hurdles such as requiring a 75% majority in the House or a public referendum on any proposed sale. It had the support of all opposition parties, including the Murray Party and United Futures' Peter Dunn, giving it the 61 votes it needed for its first reading and referral to the Finance and Expenditure Committee, narrowly defeating the 60 votes of National and ACT, who then used their majority on the committee to send it back to the chamber with a recommendation that it not be passed. Mr. Park is ready to modify the bill, and it remains to be seen if it can retain the support of the Murray Party and Peter Dunn. They also voted for the original version of the Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill No. 2, but that was back in March last year when the resignation of National's Mike Sabin temporarily reduced the number of MPs in the House to 120, leaving the government one short of a majority. A tied vote of 60-60 on the bill's first reading was enough to stop it going any further. And now, with Mr. Sabin's Northland seat taken by New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters, the combined opposition parties have the majority they need to get the bill off to a select committee. And talking of select committees, here's Rhys Lyon to report on the ground cover this week as the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee continues its assault on the mountain of submissions received on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Legal safeguards in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, designed to protect the government from being sued, may not go far enough to achieve their objective. That was the view of Medical Association Chairman Dr. Steve Childs when he appeared before the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on Wednesday.
There have been concerns raised, of course, that the existing safeguards in the TPPA could still expose the government to potential challenges. For example, potentially in the future, if a government wanted to put graphic health warnings on sugar-sweetened beverages, similar to the plain packaging and the graphic health warnings on tobacco, etc., the question we would like to ask the officials is whether they believe the safeguards built into the TPPA would indeed protect against those potential concerns. For example, I understand that although public health measures under expropriation may be excluded in the investor state dispute chapter, you could potentially still, on a state-to-state dispute, challenge the issue of graphic health warning on sugar-sweetened beverages. So it could be that the safeguards in the TPPA do not protect the government from protecting the public health measures that you may wish to introduce for New Zealanders.
And the Medical Association chairman outlined other concerns for his industry over the TPPA.
The issue of the biologics, it's also been in the media quite recently. And of course, that is the biggest growing market for therapeutics in New Zealand, most expensive, but also the fastest growing therapeutic product as well.
Dr. Childs was concerned about patent exclusivity for biologics, but first explained to the committee what biologic pharmaceuticals are.
The difference between a biologic and a chemical is just you sit down in a chemistry lab and you put some chemicals together and bang, you've made a chemical. A biologic, though, it's what you need to do is you need to get cells of, say, a hamster and get the hamster to produce what you want to produce in a big vat, and then you need to extract it and get the extraction just perfect and then turn it into some kind of pill that's effective. So it's the process of the production that you're trying to patent and you're trying to have intellectual property for.
And in another submission on the TPPA, Nurses Association President Grant Brooks also raised the issue of patent protection for biologic medicines,
which derive from protein-based living cells manufactured in a laboratory rather than traditional chemical compounds which are manufactured. These include vaccines, blood products, insulin, monoclonal antibodies such as Herceptin and Keytruda. When these have opened up a new world of effective treatments for many diseases and autoimmune conditions such as cancer and arthritis. Biologics, including the generic counterparts, which are called biosimilars, are the fastest growing and most expensive group of medicines, as our colleagues have just submitted, and these represent an increasing proportion of Pharmac's budget. The TPPA grants them a privileged position.
The TPPA increases patent exclusivity for biologics, whereby a company keeps exclusive knowledge of how to create a drug, and this caused concerns in the two separate submissions.
Under Article 18.52, market exclusivity for biologic medicines must be 8 years of data protection. The three-year difference from 5 to 8 is critical, since any delay in introducing competition will affect the medicines which can be included in the budget. It will literally be a matter of life and death to some New Zealanders if market exclusivity is pushed out towards 8 years.
Dr. Childs of the Medical Association agreed that data protection for biologics was a problem.
And if you can't get access to that data of how to produce it, the longer you can do that, the less there is going to be a biosimilar or a cheaper product on the market. So you're extending your cost monopoly for the producer of these products, of the most expensive primary treatment that we offer. It is a concern.
And Nurses Association Senior Policy Analyst Marilyn Head summed it up like this.
I just wonder what Alexander Fleming would have said when he discovered penicillin, if they'd said, right, okay, we're going to patent that, or we're going to protect that information so that only people with enough money can afford that. It is the fastest growing area of medications, and right from the outset, it is being set aside for privileged access, without discussion almost.
Marilyn Head of the Nurses Association on Wednesday, while on Thursday the committee met again to continue hearing the broad range of submissions on the TPPA, including one from New Zealand Kiwifruit Growers Chief Executive Nikki Johnson.
We just wish to confirm our support of the TPP on behalf of the growers that we represent. There's $487 million worth of exports to TPP countries last year, and that's likely to increase. TPP covers our number one market, which is Japan, where $15 million on tariffs were paid last year for kiwifruit. In addition to the tariffs, Zespri, the marketing company which is owned by growers, has invested significantly in Japan. It has its own marketing staff based there and growing operations to support our 12-month supply objectives. The TPP also includes Chile, our main competitor in kiwifruit production for the Southern Hemisphere. And to maintain competitive advantage against Chile, New Zealand must be part of the TPP and obtain the same advantages, including tariff reduction, in order to maintain competitiveness.
Nikki Johnson summed up the key benefits of the TPPA to kiwifruit growers, beginning with the reduction in Japanese tariffs.
So that's currently 6.4%, which will reduce to zero on signing, which is an annual savings of $15 million for the industry, and that relates to around $6,000 per grower that will be in savings from tariff payments. But in addition to that, it will provide increasing opportunity for marketing and innovation investment. And what that ultimately does is result in improved profits for Zespri, and Zespri is owned by New Zealand growers. So that will result in those improved profits turning back into New Zealand growers and into regional economies, and in particular the Bay of Plenty. Zespri are predicting annual sales growth increasing of 33% in Japan over the next 5 years, and 51% over the next 5 years for other TPP countries, so significant improvements in sales growth. So the TPP is of benefit to us, and we strongly support the TPP.
New Zealand Kiwifruit Growers Chief Executive Nikki Johnson with that submission on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee.
That report from Rhys Lyon, and just in this week from the Justice and Electoral Committee, its report on its inquiry into the last general election. It's this committee's job to review each general election and recommend possible improvements before the next one. Among the many recommendations in this 45-page report are changes reflecting the rapid growth in advance voting, up from just under 15% of the total vote in 2011 to just over 29% in the last election. Labour MPs on the committee are not happy, though, about the government using its majority on the committee to block a change to prevent a repetition of what happened in 2014, when some 27,000 voters had their vote disallowed because they were not on the electoral roll. More to come on that, I guess, when the report is debated in the chamber. Now, as promised last week, here's the second part of our interview with the Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows, who begins by looking at whether it makes any difference if a presiding officer comes off the opposition benches or off the Treasury benches before going into the job.
I think it's really about how you view your parliamentary career and what you're doing there and why you come to Parliament in the first place. If you're an angry parliamentarian who always insists on getting his own way on every occasion and never makes any friends, you'll probably hate the job as Speaker and you'll probably be hated as the Speaker. But actually, if you're somebody who is there and recognises that the public expect their members of Parliament to get on and not to have a fight on every occasion and use every opportunity to grandstand, but would rather that if someone had a good idea, then people voted for it, and if they didn't, they said why they wouldn't and just got on with the business of being in Parliament. And actually, I think people will respect a speaker like that, and they're worthy of respect.
Lockwood Smith came into the job 2008, 2009, after 9 years on the opposition benches asking questions. This speaker, David Carter, comes in off the ministerial benches. Do you think that makes a difference to their approach?
They've certainly got different approaches, but I think that they sort of put their own stamp on it. You've got to remember that Lockwood Smith and opposition actually led a very tidy campaign against Tito Phillip Field and was successful, and it was just about done completely on during question time and on Official Information Act requests and then the scrutiny of those in question time. So he knew the value of question time and he knew what could be achieved in question time, and we were all witness to that, so really it wasn't lost on anybody in the House. I don't think you could say that David Carter is softer on ministers because he immediately before being Speaker was answering them as a minister at all. I think that he does hold the government ministers to account pretty strongly.
Yes, I think so. I think he strikes a really good balance. I just wondered whether he was perhaps more interested in the questions, having answered them, whereas Lockwood Smith was more interested in getting the answers.
Yeah, I think somebody could take that view, but I think that they do put their own stamp on it. I think David Carter does actually insist on quite a high level of compliance with questions, but he makes the point, and quite fairly. I mean, you can't chuck him on the rack and force an answer. If a minister gives a pretty crappy answer, then he lives and dies by that. So that's what will be reported in the newspaper. That's where the press release is from the person, the opposition member. The story then becomes that the minister refuses to answer the question. Well, that's a story in itself, because the public immediately thinks, well, why won't he answer the question? So I think sometimes banging on about he's not answering the question and expecting there to be some punishment meted out for the minister for not answering the question is not the whole story. There are other ways.
Like asking another question.
Well, yeah. The minister being asked a question is being obstructive and not giving an answer or sort of answering some parallel question but not answering the question on point, then he can be drawn back to it. And what really happens is the spotlight's put on him that he's not answering the question. So you can then insist that he give another answer, but he's just going to wander out all over the place. I've never heard a minister yet give some sort of evasive answer to a supplementary question when being drawn to answer the same question again because the Speaker's allowed him to do that, that he's actually given anything completely different or sort of completely dug a hole for himself or anything else. The real condemnation is in not answering the question, and that's where the press release, that's what the public are interested in, and there are other ways of doing it, because it then gives full licence to the questioner to go out and say, well, this is the answer he wouldn't give, and then get the minister to refute that publicly. I mean, the fact is, some of these guys just aren't creative enough.
No names, no pactrel. I'm Tom Fruin. I was talking there to the Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.